started.
Okay. This is our friend Nazanin, who was converted here about 2 years ago, yes?
Yeah.
All right, and so she's going to share her story with you.
So hi guys, my name is Nazanin Hashemi. I'm a junior at San Diego State University. My entire family is all Shia Muslim, but they are by no means devout Muslims. Growing up, it would be really common to see my mom pray 3 times a day in our living room, covered head to toe. But besides prayer and avoiding the consumption of pork, my mom didn't live by the Quran at all. My dad did not practice Islam at all, but rather it was just part of his upbringing. And so growing up, my dad was never really present in my life. I later found out that my dad was addicted to gambling and smoking. So growing up, my relationship with my dad was really strained. I saw God as a figure that was very similar to my dad, never present. And the brokenness in my relationship with my dad left me really confused as a teen. He was not living the life of a Muslim. And so a little background of my dad's family, they were Sayyid. And so that's like an honorific title, saying that we're part of Muhammad's lineage. And so Muhammad was part of the Qureshi tribe, and one of the branching clans was the Hashim clan, which is where I got my last name. So my dad's title as a Sayyid was something that my family was really proud about and that they loved to share with people. It was a really big deal in my family to be related to Muhammad. And although there was a lot of weight to my dad's lineage, I didn't really care growing up. I was sort of this teen that didn't care about how my parents wanted me to live. All I wanted in my life was to fill the void of not having a father present in my life. I wanted to be as far away from my family as possible. And I lived in a typical Persian home where appearance was everything. And so I basically grew up fearing my parents so much. And so something my parents would always reiterate is that God is always watching me. And so this led me to have the basis of my relationship with God to be rooted in fear. And so whenever I thought about God, although I knew nothing about God as a teen, I thought he was constantly trying to keep track of where I fell short. He was distant and not part of my present life. In the present, I chose to disobey my parents and live a life that worshiped my own desires and wants. In high school, my family would be constantly fighting about different issues, and I just wanted to escape. I wanted to make myself numb to the constant hurting that I dealt with at home. My family was the one area of my life that I had zero control over. This left me feeling frustrated and really angry with God. I was extremely worldly growing up. Whenever I wouldn't be able to handle my situation at home, I would turn to put my security in relationships and guys. No one knew about the fact that every single day I would go home and cry myself to sleep because I felt so empty. I would cry out to God, whoever God was, asking him to fix my problems. I wanted him to fix my dad especially. I doubted that could happen, but eventually God interceded in my life in a different way. When I was a sophomore in high school, I was enrolled in a dance class. In that class, I met a girl named Stephanie Carell, who reached out to me and became my instant best friend. She would constantly invite me to come to Teen Bible Talk with her on Tuesdays, events on Fridays, and church on Sundays, but I'd always refuse. I probably refused to go to church about 10 times. My mom didn't want me to go either. Bible Talk was about 30 minutes away from my house, and my parents thought it was unnecessary. My first time out to church was back in 2011. Stephanie was performing a skit in the Mission Region's Christmas service, and I went only to support her. At least that's what I thought. Little did I know that day Stephanie and Mallory Melcher Post would ask me to study the Bible. I had never opened a Bible before. I was such a people pleaser that I couldn't say no. we set up weekly Bible studies, and I studied the Bible for about a year and a half. During this time, my parents allowed me to go to church and study the Bible because they thought it was like a hobby, like dancing or going to the mall. I'm so grateful for Stephanie's family because for almost 2 years, they would drive me to Bible Talk, events, and church. They never gave up on me. This is one of the things that attracted me to Christ. Never before had I seen people who laid down their life for me. They really laid down their Christianity. And then while I was studying the Bible, I was really blinded by my pride. The girls that studied the Bible with me would explain the gospel in such an amazing way, and they were really patient with me in all my questions. And although I learned a lot, it was their friendship with me that made the biggest difference. It was just crazy that they had nothing to gain for themselves, but they were only trying to please Christ. And so as I was studying the Bible, I learned that I had a lot of repenting to do. And so something that I learned was that I'd never before seen God as a father figure and someone who desired to be in a relationship with me. When I began to study out how God loved me and viewed me, I realized that he's nothing like my earthly father. And I was so excited to learn more about God, but then I had a lot of doubts. My parents began to tell me that they thought I was hanging out with my church friends too much. They thought I was getting brainwashed. Before deciding to give my life over to God, I decided to study out the difference between Islam and Christianity. I picked up Douglas Jacoby's Compelling Evidence for God in the Bible. A couple of things stood out to me in this book. I learned that Muslims believe that Jesus came from God, but he wasn't the Son of God. I found this statement to be in contradiction to the Bible, because Jesus himself says in John 14:6, "I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me." Therefore, I realized that if Muslims believe Jesus is from God, they must believe the words he spoke about himself. He claims to be the only way. Also, another thing that drew me to Christ was that in every religion, like Islam, people have to do so many things, like cleanse themselves, do a bunch of works, and sacrifice time to get to God. But in Christianity, Christ actually came down to us, and there's nothing that I can do to be worthy of his love. And so after discovering this, I knew I had to get baptized. So on July 21st, 2013, I made Jesus Lord in my life. And so this was the best decision I ever made. The entire course of my life changed, my dreams, my desires. But then I still received persecution from my family since then. But something that I always like find comfort in is the scripture in Psalm 27:10. It says, "Though my father and mother forsake me, the Lord will receive me." Thank you.
So Nazanin, you're saying that you weren't converted by people telling you how your religion was wrong and how the Quran was wrong. It was because they loved you and they showed you the love of Jesus? Amen. Dan. It's still on.
We were hoping for a smooth transition, but... Thought we had to root for the virtuals. Go virtual! Thought that was the team or something. Thank you for sharing. That adds a lot. Just instead of this cold academic stuff, see it for real. But I'll talk books here for a second. That might be helpful. I said earlier part of our recommended reading for this was Doug's book, which I think we had a few copies still there, on Jesus and Islam. Nabil Qureshi, this book just came out, and so it deals with a lot of current issues, and so as you can see, it's a very short, quick read, and so he does a great job with it. Probably the one book I would have recommended, this Answering Islam by Geisler and Salib. Salib is not his real name, Abdul Salib. He's actually from Iran, so he's a Persian former Muslim that now the pastor of an Iranian American congregation on the East Coast. And has a PhD in Islamic studies, although I don't think he had that yet when he wrote this with Dr. Norman Geisler. But So this used to be kind of the go-to book for Christian apologetics to Islam. It still is really good, but it's a little dated now. It's an older book, and as you can see, much thicker than Nabil's book there. So there's a little more reading to it, but there's a lot of great information there. And then this is Nabil's other book, his earlier book, which is it's out in a new edition now. Seeking Allah, Finding Jesus. Just a great guy, and has an incredible story. Steve was asking earlier about translations of the Quran. As I said before, it's good to get as many good English translations as you can find, and there's a lot of them. Probably the most readable, this is the bestseller, is the Penguin Classics edition, translated by Dawood. Fairly easy to find, and it's been around for a long time. Dawood was from Iran, emigrated to England, and did this translation of the Quran. He's not Muslim, however, so he pretty much translates it straight the way he thinks the Arabic reads. And so Muslims are a little uncomfortable with this translation. If it says in Surah 4, beat your wife and send her to bed, that's how he's going to translate it. He's not going to sugarcoat it. Whereas Muslim translators of the Quran tend to smooth some things over a little bit for an English reading audience. And so they don't like Dawood. Yeah, go ahead. It's spelled Dawood, D-A-W-O-O-D, N-J Dawood. And this is the Penguin Classics edition. It's been around a long time, pretty easy to find. The downside, it's very readable. The downside of it is it's kind of the Reader's Digest condensed version of the Quran. The Quran is very repetitive, and so he takes a few things out of it just so they're not rehashed over and over. And then if you're wanting to really study, you're wanting to find some of these different surat that we're talking about today, he's a little loose with the versification. And so it's hard if you're trying to do more of a serious study of it. If you just want readability, it's one of the best ones, and so that's why it's still popular. This one is a little more scholarly. This is the Oxford World Classics edition from M.A.S. Abdel Halim. That's Halim, H-A-L-E-E-M. He is a Muslim scholar in England. I think he's at the School of Oriental and African Studies there. So this is a Muslim scholar that's actually there now. And so he does a translation, pretty readable. It's a little better on the versification if you're wanting to find particular verses. And he is a scholar, so he tries to put in study notes and introduce each surah a little bit. So he helps you out there. But he is Muslim, so he's going to try to put the best spin on it that he can. And whereas Dawood is going to be a little more blunt. But if you're wanting kind of a more serious study from a Muslim perspective, it's a pretty readable translation that's pretty easy to negotiate. But I'm not saying those are the best or the only ones, but just offering some ideas. I know of one that attempts to put it in chronological order. Bill Warner for the Center of Study of Political Islam, he has a kind of a Quran that's like chronological. Of course, we're just speculating on what the exact chronological order would be. And he has kind of a condensed version as well. He has a version where you can read it very quickly because they've taken out a lot of the repetition. And so that's an option too if you want to kind of get the Meccan surahs and all that. And which brings us to some of those things. But John covered a lot on the Quran. As he mentioned, it's said to be eternal. It's there with Allah. Now, the Quran has always existed. Now, if you remember, John talked about the sin of shirk, of associating anything with Allah. Allah is wholly other. He is transcendent. He is above male and female. Don't call him female, though. I think caused some problems, but Allah is above male and female, above, he's beyond personal and impersonal. Allah defies all categories. There's nothing like Allah. Now, Allah is also immanent. He's among us. In Christianity, the concept of God is very integrated. There's the what theologians call the immanence, the immanence of God, that he's present right here with us. Christianity also emphasizes the transcendence of God, that he's above and beyond everything. He's above and beyond his creation, as well as being present within his creation. So you have all these attributes of God that are very balanced. You know, they're very integrated. The view of Allah that's spelled out in Islam is he is immanent. There's a verse in the Quran that talks about Allah is closer than your jugular vein. You know, he's right here, super close. But the transcendence of Allah is really emphasized. Allah is transcendent. He's wholly other from anything else. And very distant. And that's emphasized. Also, the power of Allah is emphasized. The will of Allah. Allah does whatever Allah chooses to do. Allah has that power and can just will things, even somewhat capriciously, at least from our perspective. And so Allah is lifted up, and you can't associate anything with him. Allah is the only God, and to associate anything with Allah is idolatrous. It's shirk. But you can't help but wonder, so how is this Quran eternal, that it's been with Allah for all eternity? Isn't that associating something with Allah? And the first of the five pillars of Islam is saying the Shahada, confessing in Arabic that, with sincerity, that the only God is Allah and Muhammad is his prophet. Isn't the Shahada associating Muhammad with Allah? The very confession you're supposed to say to, you know, become a Muslim? So there's these, you know, little questions here of how it's a coherent, you know, worldview. But so you could think of the Quran as I would like to think of it, I think it would make sense as a body of knowledge that Allah has, and so it's eternal with Allah. But that's not how classical Islam has always interpreted it. They say it's a literal tablet in heaven, maybe the size of a table, and it has all the verses of the Quran written on it. And that has been from eternity with Allah. So it's written there with Allah in a very difficult 7th century dialect of Arabic that just happens to be the same tribal dialect as Muhammad. You know, it's just been there for all eternity. It just happens to be the Quraysh dialect. And so it is up there, and Surah 43:4, I think John mentioned some of these. Surah 43, Ayah 4, it is truly exalted in the source of Scripture, kept with us, and full of wisdom. So the source of Scripture is kept with Allah up in heaven with him. Surah 85, Ayat 21 through 22. This is truly a glorious Quran on a preserved tablet. So sometimes the Quran is referred to as the mother of the book. This is the ultimate book. But some Muslim scholars would say, well, a better way of looking at it would be the Quran with Allah. That's the mother of the book that we have here. That is the source of the Scripture that we have here. It is with Allah from all eternity. Abdullah Yusuf Ali did a very popular English translation of the Quran. He says, quote, "The mother of the book, the foundation of knowledge, the preserved tablet, is the core or essence of revelation, the original principle or fountainhead of Allah's eternal and universal law. From this fountainhead are derived all streams of knowledge and wisdom that flow through time and feed the intelligence of created minds. The mother of the book is in Allah's own presence, and its dignity and wisdom are more than all we can think of in the spiritual world." Now, this was there in heaven, allegedly, and Jibril, the angel Gabriel, recited it. He would come and recite it to Muhammad. And Muhammad would memorize it, and then he would recite it. And then his companions and followers would recite. And eventually some of them would start writing bits and pieces of it down. Now this is in Al-Bukhari, where it's talked about how the Quran was preserved. And so it's written down on just bits of bone and strips of leather. And so it appears what scholars would look at as age memoir. It's more just memory, you know, mnemonic devices to help you remember what you're supposed to recite. Because it was purely oral. It was just a pure recitation. And so that's how they kept it. They just kind of had a few crib notes of it, but it was mostly just memorization. It was never really written down. It was never collected as a book during the lifetime of Muhammad. And the Council on American Islamic Relations had on their website, they said the Quran, quote, was memorized by Muhammad and then dictated to his companions. The text of the Quran was cross-checked during the life of the Prophet. The 114 chapters of the Quran have remained unchanged through the centuries, end quote. There is one of the top Muslim debaters in the UK on BBC radio a few years ago, Adnan Rashid. He claimed that Muhammad had 100,000 companions that recited the Quran five times a day, every day. Well, I think it would be hard to get 100,000 followers on Twitter, let alone in Central Arabia back then. But, and to recite the Quran five times a day, every day, well, these just came out piecemeal over a 23-year period. So it wouldn't be the full Quran. You would start out with a little bit here and there. But eventually, I mean, the complete 114 surat of the Quran, that takes approximately 9 hours to recite from beginning to end. So so they're doing this about 45 hours a day, every day. I don't know, it seems like your mouth will get a little dry after a while. The desert's bad enough. But so he said that and didn't really provide any sources for it in the Islamic sources, but he made that claim for the Quran that it's been eternal and unchanged. We got a direct download from Allah to Muhammad. It's been perfectly preserved. I think you've already seen this afternoon there's reasons to really doubt that that's the case. There's a great article that was written in The Atlantic in 1999. It's free online by Toby Lester about the Quran, and he interviewed a lot of the top scholars, and Toby Lester observes, quote, despite its repeated assertions to the contrary, however, the Quran is often extremely difficult for contemporary readers, even highly educated speakers of Arabic, to understand. It sometimes makes dramatic shifts in style, voice, and subject matter from verse to verse, and it assumes a familiarity with language, stories, and events that seem to have been lost, even to the earliest Muslim exegetes, typical of a text that initially evolved in an oral tradition. Its apparent inconsistencies are easy to find. God may be referred to in the third and first person in the same sentence. Divergent versions of the same story are repeated at different points in the text. Divine rulings occasionally contradict one another. In this last case, the Quran anticipates criticism and defends itself by asserting the right to abrogate its own message. And John's already gone into the idea of abrogation, and it's tied into the Meccan versus the Medinan surahs. And this is some information from Michael Cook. So he kind of lays out a table. This is in his brief introduction to the Quran. He has Medinan on one side, and or actually Meccan on one side and Medinan on the other. Mecca are the ones that Muhammad allegedly revealed in Mecca, and then later he's in Medina and reveals some more. And the earlier ones, Mecca, tend to be like the last half of the Quran, and the later ones are in the front half of the Quran. But the Meccan surahs, generally speaking, go ahead. Scholars acknowledge it, and they kind of have a broad consensus about Witchermeckin and Witchermerdinen, but it's a broad consensus, though, because it's really the subject matter changes within a surah, and so it's hard to tell. You know, is this a Medinan surah referring back to something that happened in Mecca? It's really hard to nail it down, but there's a general idea. These are Meccan and these are Medinan, and they kind of resolve it in different ways. But the Meccan surahs, generally speaking, tend to be shorter, and the Medinan tend to be the longer ones. The Meccan ones tend to be more poetic. This is when he's in Mecca and he's preaching and doing all this. The Medinan ones tend to be more plain spoken. The Meccan surah tend to be more focused on the past. They're talking about Noah and Ibrahim and the prophets of old. And the Medinan ones are dealing with the present and the future. They're kind of dealing with the status quo in Medina. And along with that, the Meccan surah tend to be more on Muhammad's credentials as a prophet. He's in this ongoing battle with the Meccans of, no, I'm not a poet, no, I'm not a soothsayer, no, I'm not a false prophet, no, I'm not just a storyteller. And so he's kind of having to defend himself. You can think of the Apostle Paul in the New Testament having to defend himself as an apostle. Muhammad has a similar battle to be taken seriously as a prophet. So that's what the Meccan surahs tend to be more about. A little more flowery, a little more poetic, and a little more about establishing his credentials, usually by comparison to past prophets. Because he's saying, don't reject me and my message. Think of what happened when those people rejected Noah and his message. You know, so he's associating himself with that. Whereas the Medinan surahs are more, as I said, about the present and the future and community norms. Because he's ruling Medina, and will later go on to conquer Mecca. So he's laying out the norms for the Muslim community. The Ummah is what they call the Muslim community. So he's dealing with the present and the future, and here's how things are going to be run. He's no longer really defending his status as a prophet. He's a religious, political, and military leader, spelling out, here's how wives are to be treated, here's how this is to be done. So those are some distinctions that scholars have noticed, but it does get a little difficult at times to know which is which. But there's a general consensus, and this is the difficulty, is the later surat abrogate the earlier surat. So all these verses in Mecca about, you have your religion, I have my religion, Christianity's cool, Jews are cool, all those are in the Meccan surat. And those are abrogated by surahs like Surah 9, that are considered part of the Medinan surah. Some think Surah 9 might actually be the last surah revealed, or maybe second to last. So Surah 9 is one of the last ones, and also probably the most violent surah in the Quran. They're not chronological. They're not chronological at all. In fact, I think it's Surah 96, they think, that might be the first one or one of the first ones. There's one that talks about where he was initially met by Jibreel in the cave at Mount Hira. And so it gets really confusing because it jumps around quite a bit. As I said, scholars have a general idea which are which, but it gets disputable on some of them. But that's the general rule that... go ahead. Some do. Some think that is the order of the surah is divinely inspired. That's not what everybody would argue. It's a little hard to argue that, but go ahead.
What's the, I see
Yeah. Well, you would have more liberal, more Western Muslims that would not have a problem with a lot of this. They would see, well, the Quran is just a body of knowledge that Allah has. It's not a physical thing. And a lot of these historical and scientific problems in the Quran, they would say, well, those are just figures of speech. And so it's easy to resolve if you do it that way. The difficulty is classical Islam. You look at the tafsir writers like Tabari, like Ibn Kathir, and Jalalain, and some of these. They take the Quran very literally. It's the literal word of Allah, and it should be interpreted in a very literal way. And more fundamentalist Muslims, more conservative Muslims, that's how they read it. And so the verses on abrogation, it's always emphasizing Allah's power, that he can change it if he wants to change it. You know, he can. And remember, it's easy to conceive of Quran as a recitation. It's an oral discourse. So Allah, so it's not written down at first. So Allah is saying, I can take a verse of the Quran out of your mind, and I can replace it with something else. And so you recite something different. And none of it's written down. So it's pretty easy to revise, kind of an oral, you know, body of knowledge. But once it gets written down, then it's like, okay, why is this canceling out this other thing, especially if it's eternal? So I think a more conservative Muslim would just appeal to Allah's power, and Allah has the power, and just, you know, this is Allah's will to do that. Whereas more Western Muslims would be like, well, this is just a body of knowledge. And there was an early fight in the early days of Islam between the Mu'tazilites, who were more rational, more philosophically minded, that they thought that the Mu'tazili thought that that's how we should think of the Quran. It makes more sense if it's just kind of some knowledge that's been there with Allah. It doesn't make sense to see it as a literal. And they were against the Asharites, who thought it's a literal tablet written that's in heaven with Allah. And the Asharites won that battle. It was kind of an ongoing debate for about 100 years in the history of Islam. And the more philosophical-minded ones lost. And so we've been left with the more literal, you know, that it is an actual thing that's in heaven. It's a little harder to work with that view, but they just lost. You know, they just lost in Muslim history. Surah 10, Ayah 15, clearly says that even Muhammad could not change a single word of the Quran, even if he wanted to. It's from Allah. Surah 10, Ayah 15, and then Surah 69, Ayah 40 through 48, Allah even says this, most surely it is the word brought by an honored apostle, and it is not the word of a poet. Little is it that you believe, nor the word of a soothsayer. Little is it in your mind. It is a revelation from the Lord of the worlds, and if he had fabricated against us some of the sayings, we would certainly have seized him by the right hand, then we would certainly have cut off his aorta. And not one of you could have withheld us from him, and most surely it is a reminder for those who guard against evil. So Allah basically says, you know, if Muhammad dared to falsify anything in the Quran or prophesy falsely, then Allah was going to strike his aorta, you know, his heart, his life vein. Which, curiously, there's a number of ahadith that say that is how Muhammad died. So you have to, and these are Sahih hadith. This is in Bukhari, and there's a number of hadith. I think it's in Sahih Muslim as well. So that's interesting in and of itself. John already mentioned the Sana manuscripts. I won't go into those a lot, but the Grand Mosque in Yemen, that's southern Arabia there. It's one of the first mosques built in the history of Islam. And 1972, they're doing some, there was some damage to the building. They're doing some renovations. And they found this whole cache of documents in this loft. And it was very ancient Arabic script. Nobody could read it. And so these were hundreds of documents, but no one could read it. So they're like, this is something. We don't really know what it is. And there were no scholars in the Muslim world that could read it. So they had to go to Germany and have some non-Muslims, some secular scholars come and examine the manuscripts, experts on Arabic calligraphy. And this is in the Toby Lester article at The Atlantic, where they talk. He interviews Garrett Quinn, and who's one of the scholars that did this. But they look at it, and Garrett Quinn's an expert on Arabic calligraphy and the ancient, you know, writing. He realizes right away, it's like some of this is Quranic material. And it's material that doesn't match the Qurans we have today. And so he sees what it is, and their hosts there in Yemen start getting wind of, okay, this isn't sounding very good. So they send the two German scholars home without the microfilm, without the photographs they had taken of the documents. But later, the microfilm was released to them. They got it back, but that was the end of the project. This was a collaborative project between Sarsland University in Germany and Saarbrücken, and with a Yemeni Antiquities Authority. That pretty much ended the project, and by all accounts, those manuscripts are still there, not well secured, not really being studied. Some scholars have expressed concern that they're not being very well preserved. They could easily be lost or stolen or burned in a fire. But, it was in 72 they were first discovered. And so no. But these, Gerd Quinn, and there was Botmer, and there were some other scholars that got to look at them. And their conclusion is this has not been preserved in the exact surah order. There's variation, not just between the Qurans we have today, but the different documents that they found there at Sana, they don't match each other either. So they're like, it looks like the Quran was a much more fluid text, because these are dated to late 7th, early 8th century. They're like, it looks like there wasn't an set order of surahs. Some of the surahs, surat, are not in there. And so it's like, it doesn't look like this has been perfectly preserved, word for word, letter for letter, in exact surat order. It looks like it was a little more fluid in the early days. Andrew Rippon, a scholar in Canada, says, the impact of the Yemeni manuscripts is still to be felt. Their variant readings and verse orders are all very significant. Everybody agrees on that. These manuscripts say that the early history of the Quranic text is much more of an open question than many have suspected. The text was less stable and therefore had less authority than has always been claimed. And then one of the actual scholars that studied the manuscripts, Gerd Quinn, he said, quote, my idea is that the Quran is a kind of cocktail of texts that were not all understood even at the time of Muhammad. Many of them may even be 100 years older than Islam itself. Even within the Islamic traditions, there is a huge body of contradictory information, including a significant Christian substrate. One can derive a whole Islamic anti-history from them if one wants. So he's saying there's a lot of unanswered questions here, and he's like, you could almost build an entirely different history of Islam and the Quran just based on the disagreements there. But now, does the Quran as we have it today contain, does it contain a body of material from the 7th century that's kind of associated with Muhammad? Yeah, it does. But if you're talking word for word, perfect preservation, just as it came in the 7th century, we clearly don't have that. Go ahead. Oh, you're stretching? Yeah. Yeah, they appeal to all of it, to the Quran, to the Sira literature, to the Hadith literature. They pretty much appeal to all of it. And I'm about to jump into that here. But the Sira literature, well, the oldest, most authoritative example of Sira literature is Life of Muhammad that I did have. There it is. Life of Muhammad by Ibn Ishaq. He's writing in the 8th century. And he was born in Medina and then immigrates to what would be modern day Iraq. And Ibn Ishaq, a faithful Muslim, and he went out and kind of lectured about the life of Muhammad from things he had read and studied. And we actually don't have what he wrote. We just have, like, there were different people got a hold of different lecture notes. And so one of his disciples, Ibn Hisham, will take this up. And so what we have here is Ibn Ishaq's early 8th century tale of Muhammad's life, but we have it mediated through Ibn Hisham. And Ibn Hisham, that's looking at 833 to 828, kind of that range. So this is actually 9th century, and Muhammad is in the 7th century. And Ibn Hisham, he admits, it's in the introduction here, Ibn Hisham wrote, quote, "I am omitting things with Ishaq recorded in this book. I have omitted things which are disgraceful to discuss and matters which would distress certain people," unquote. So this is put forward as this is the oldest, most accurate, most authoritative life of Muhammad that we have. And it is. And it's like, and this guy was like from Arabia, which he was. He wasn't really from Mecca. He didn't know Muhammad or his companions. He lived a lot of his life in what would be modern day Iraq, in kind of Persian territory. And then so we have kind of somebody else's, a 9th century version of his notes here. So this is being written long after the life of Muhammad. So, how reliable is the Sira? This is the earliest one. If you're doing, if you're writing a life of Muhammad, there's more Sira literature after this, but they're all relying on him. He's the earliest and greatest one. And this is, coming, 200 years later, after life of Muhammad. Then you have the Hadith literature. One thing about Ibn Hisham, too, he was living in Egypt. I think he was kind of from the Iraq area, and then lived in Egypt most of his life. And so some think he never actually went to Arabia. He might have been once. But then you have the Hadith literature. Al-Bukhari is kind of the king of that. You kind of have, he's doing this as well much later. Al-Bukhari, that's the short version of his name, but Bukhari means he's from someone from Bukhara. It's a Persian name meaning someone from Bukhara. Bukhara is what would today be known as Uzbekistan. So he's not an Arab. He's Persian. He's not from Arabia. He didn't know Muhammad or any of his companions. This is a Persian scholar, a devout Muslim, super smart. He's kind of trying to reconstruct the life of Muhammad much later. And so he's probably the greatest one of the... I'm looking for that right now. Yeah, so this is 800s as well. But page through. I'm kind of having to carry my CB radio here, so makes it a little different to page. Yeah, 10-4. Put the hammer down. Good buddy. Yeah, go ahead. Okay. Yeah, Quran, Hadith, and yeah. So you have is it here? So it's about 833 that Bukhari's collection is being put together. Bukhari had claimed to have found in the neighborhood of 300,000 Hadith. He then gets rid of about 90% of those, and so the ones he has left, they're different versions of the same story. So it comes down to just a little under 3,000 distinct stories from the life of Muhammad. So in the 9th century, there's thousands, according to them, hundreds of thousands of hadith, all these stories. And so how would you verify any of these stories 200 years later? These oral traditions of Muhammad. And you go right down the list of the six canonical hadith collections, Bukhari, Sahih Muslim, Al-Tirmidhi. Most of these are Persian scholars 200 years later. They're men that, they're not Arabs, they're not from Arabia, they're not people that knew Muhammad or the events. And so all our stories about Muhammad's life that we use to figure out what's going on the Quran, all the hadith about his life that we use to try to figure out what's in the Quran, how accurate are any of these stories? And then we have... the tafsir literature, the commentaries on the Quran. So you have the Tariq, the world according to Islam, and then you have the tafsir, the commentaries. Those are also coming much later. This is 9th and 10th century with Al-Tabri. Now, he was a genius, super smart, a devout Muslim, but Tabari is a Persian name. It means someone from Tabaristan, which would be like northern Iraq, northern Iran, somewhere in that area. So the commentaries on the Quran, the stories of the sayings of the life of Muhammad, the life of Muhammad, everything we have is from 300 years later. And we're trying to use that to understand this very difficult to understand Quran. And it's been said Islam sprang out in the full light of history, that, we know more about Muhammad historically than we know about Jesus. And when you look at the actual sources, the sources aren't that great. When you think the 27 books of the New Testament can all be securely dated to the first century within the living memory of eyewitnesses, you know, the friends and the foes of Jesus, whereas this is all developed much later. And we have to question really the accuracy of it. And as I said earlier today, we've never had a lot of context history for the life of Muhammad. We've just gone by these Muslim sources. We had nothing, not much else to go on. But as we learn more from different sources about pre-Islamic Arabia, there's a number of things that just raise questions. If you remember, I mentioned Muhammad, 7th century, the days there in Arabia, that Mecca, you know, was this mighty city. The Quran refers to a mother of cities, this great town, and we assume it's referring to Mecca. The word Mecca actually only appears once in the Quran. And the earliest reference we have, other than the Quran, is 8th century. And a lot of early maps don't have the city of Mecca. Then this was supposed to be a major commercial center on the trade route. But when historians like Robert Hoyland and others, Patricia Corona, Michael Cook, when they've looked at it, well, let's get some context history, because they were obviously trading with someone. Let's look at their records and see what we can find out about Arabia. And they're not finding Mecca on maps. They're not finding it on trade routes. They're not finding it mentioned. They find other cities in Arabia mentioned. Mecca isn't mentioned until getting into like 9th and 10th century, basically after Muslims come streaming out of Arabia and start conquering and everything. And this is from the Sira on page 46. Ibn Ishaq is writing, "When they left the Yaman, they refused to go unless they had a king to order their affairs. When they came to Mecca, they saw a town blessed with water and trees and delighted with it, and they settled there." Water and trees in Mecca? Here you have an early Muslim source. This is the best biography we have of Muhammad. And it's claiming there was water, there was trees. And there in Mecca, other Muslim sources, there's an independent researcher in Canada, Dan Gibson. He wrote a book called Quranic Geography several years ago. And his idea was, he was like, the Quran mentions a lot of locations, geographical locations. Let's go research these different locations. And so he was coming up to the same conclusions as Patricia Crona and some of these other scholars. He's like, well, in Tabari's histories and in the Sira, in the Quran, you have, he's dialoguing with agriculturalists, and it's talking about there were olive groves in Mecca, and there were growing grapes and wine, and it was this fertile, irrigated, cultivated valley. It was this grassy valley. It's like, there's no evidence of this. You look at Mecca today, it's like it's part of the biggest desert in the world. And the valley of Mecca isn't in a valley. It's this dusty plain. It's not a valley. There's a location I mentioned earlier, Mount Hira, where Muhammad allegedly had his first revelation. Is this cave on Mount Hira, and they have a little rocky little hole in the ground where they say today that it is, but it's on the opposite side of that mountain. He couldn't look down and see Mecca from there, or people couldn't see him. And the accounts mention people looking for him. So that doesn't seem to have been the location. Plus, it talks about him being with a Hanif there at one point, and it's too small, really, for it's barely big enough for one person. So that location doesn't seem to be fit the cave at Mount Hira described in the Islamic sources. And then this mighty walled city of Mecca, this big trading town, you know, it's described as having trees and all these temples, and also it's able to have these huge armies. You know, all the battles with Muhammad, it can. It has all these people. It never seemed to run out of, you know, hundreds of troops to send up after him. So it had to be this huge city, but there's just no evidence for it being that large a settlement there in the 7th century. There might have been a Mecca there, but it wasn't this huge walled city with gardens and temples and everything. It just... Muhammad was born in the year of the elephant, and they describe looking down from the mountains around Mecca and seeing the elephant charging the Kaaba, and the elephant wouldn't harm the Kaaba. It reverenced the Kaaba, so it was kind of this mystical kind of thing. But we look at modern-day Mecca, and there are some very low mountains, but they're not that close to the city. They're not steep mountains around the city where you could look down with the naked eye and see into the city, or look up from the city and see if Muhammad was up on the mountain. So the Mecca we have today just doesn't match the descriptions in the Islamic sources. So it's an open question. Are these Persian scholars in another time, in another place? Is this being made up out of whole cloth? Or are they describing someplace else? Because some of the geography, Dan Gibson's theory, some of the geography matches northern Arabia. It doesn't match southern Arabia, central Arabia at all. It certainly doesn't match our contemporary city of Mecca. So the more we learn about Islam, as we dig into the Quran, as we dig into the sources, the more it seems to fall apart in your hands. This solid world religion based on history. We know everything Muhammad said and did. Well, we do have a lot of writings that say what he said and did, but they don't seem to have a strong connection with 7th century Arabia and anything anyone would have done there. Some have even questioned, was there a historical Muhammad? Now, I think there was. Nabil Qureshi would say, yeah, I think 90% sure there was a historical Muhammad that led this jihad out of Arabia. But the sources are just so late. How much we can really say about the historical Muhammad, that's kind of an open question. But
yeah, go ahead.
Yeah.
Earlier, we were told that to have to actually scrutinize these scriptures is just so against what they're allowed to do.
Yeah.
It sounds like the whole purpose of it was to keep adherence to this religion in total complete ignorance, so that all these things that don't make sense are not even investigated and allow a person to actually develop a true faith if these things were true or were verifiable.
Yeah.
There's so many holes.
Yeah, there's a book by Tom Holland called In the Shadow of the Sword. It was just published a few years ago. He's kind of a popular historian. His background is in English literature and classics. He's a guy in England that's written, he wrote about the fall of the Roman Empire. He wrote a best-selling book about the fall of the Persian Empire. And he's done specials on the BBC. So he took up, what about the Muslim Empire? What can we... you know, put together, and it's a 400-page book, but it's really well written. It's really an entertaining read. But he puts forward is the Roman Empire had one state religion, which we would look at as Roman Catholicism. It was Christianity at that point in time. It was one religion. It was located in one place. And the Romans kind of had a creation myth. They kind of had a founding story of Romulus and Remus and how Rome began. And then you had the Sasanian Empire over here of the Persians, and they kind of had their own founding story of how their civilization came to be. And they had their own kind of state-sponsored religion, which was Zoroastrianism. And he was like, the Arabian Empire didn't have that. But you could make one. You could make a founding story with a founding prophet, and you could kind of have some sacred scriptures just like the other great empires. And so it's an interesting theory, and it's like Gerard Quinn says, you can kind of create a whole alternate history of Islam based on what we have. Oh, Tom Holland. And he actually did a documentary based on his book for the BBC. They showed it once in England, and then there was a protest from the Muslims, and so they never showed it again. But the book is much better. The book is called In the Shadow of the Sword by Tom Holland. Very entertaining read, but it's about 400 pages, so you know it's a little bit of an endeavor. But yeah, it's just like just over an hour, maybe an hour and 15-minute thing for the BBC. But you can find that online, although it doesn't really hit everything that's in the book really that well. But another thing, if you're interested in this, there's a lecture on YouTube by a scholar at the University of Chicago named Fred Donner. And Fred Donner has written a book called Muhammad and the Believers. That's kind of his alternate history of how Islam began. But there's a lecture called How Islam Began by Fred Donner, and it's, I think, 45 minutes to an hour. It's on YouTube. You can watch it for free. And he gets into what historically can we really know about how Islam began. And he's not an apologist for Islam. He's not a polemicist against Islam. He's just a scholar and a very respected scholar of the Middle East and Islam. And he's just kind of, you know, here's what it is. And he gives what we kind of talked about this morning. He calls it the traditional origins narrative of Islam, about, you know, Muhammad and his first revelation and all that. And he has a book where he talks about what he thinks actually happened. But it's a good lecture, not an electrifying one, but an informative lecture. He is a college professor, and after all, John's kind of an exception. Yeah, John's maybe an exception. John's an exception to the rule. Go ahead. It did for a few different reasons because Muslims will point to this. They'll point to the golden age of Islam when the empire was ruled from Baghdad, which is another interesting thing. Why wasn't the Muslim empire ruled from Mecca? Why is everybody bowing five times and praying towards Mecca, the Kaaba in Mecca? But Mecca was never the capital city of the empire. Muslim leaders would always be Medina or Damascus or Baghdad, or Mecca was never really a thing, and it became this kind of center of worship. You know, you're praying five times a day in that direction, but strange, since it was, you know, if it's the mother of cities, why isn't everything run out of there? Which I'm sure the Saudis would say, hey, yeah, why isn't everything run out of here? But even they are in Riyadh. They're not, you know, their capital city isn't Mecca. But so there's a lot of, when the Muslims came out, they took over these failing empires. You know, they went into Roman territory, they went into Persian territory, and they kind of take over. And these empires already had administrators. And so it's easy just to collaborate. Okay, you guys won. Instead of collecting taxes for the Sasanian Empire, we'll collect it for you guys now. And so a lot of the scholars, they just kind of inherited, these two civilizations that Islam took over. And so then a lot of Muslim scholars are able to kind of take and develop more things, mathematics and astronomy and some of these different things, able to take some of the Greek, philosophy and some of that and kind of work with it. And so there was a lot of, invention and learning in that golden age of Islam, but it wasn't necessarily invented by Muslims. Much of it was developed by Muslims. And so a Muslim apologist will occasionally take a lot of credit for this. Well, oh, hey, we gave you all this Greek learning. Europe was in shambles, and you guys got all this learning and great philosophy from us. And that's how you guys developed science, and you guys developed the Renaissance in Europe. But if that's the case, why didn't modern science develop in the Muslim world instead of in Europe? If they had all of this. Which another question would be, yes, we did get a lot of ancient learning from the Muslim world, because the scholars were fleeing the Muslim conquest and came west into Europe and brought a lot of their texts and everything with them. So it's a more complicated story. Muslims definitely did develop a lot of things, and we did benefit in Europe from those things, but it's a little more complicated than that. But are we going to take another break, and then are you going to close? Okay, and John's going to close us out with some tips for sharing with Muslims and some of the different Muslim groups. Cool.
3-minute break.